This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
This is the podcast making public transit, taking, kiss, stealing, wheeling, dealing, son of a gun, Tim the Nerd, welcoming you to another episode of Friends Talking Nerdy, part of the Deluxe Edition Network. Head to deluxeeditionnetwork.com to find out about all of the lovely shows on the den. And seated next to me, dressed up as warm as she could, channeling the heat that is coming from the heater on this 16-degree day as we record this, the greatest legal mind in the Pacific Northwest, Professor Aubrey. How you doing?
I'm so good, Tim.
So good that you're warm.
Yes, I'm so good to be home and toasty and not out on the road and... It was great to, you know, get home and see the kitties, see you, and it's lovely.
Indeed. Now, what a weird couple of days we had with the weather here. Now, for folks that have been to the Pacific Northwest, specifically Portland, Oregon, I can't speak for Seattle. I mean, being that they're more further north, they probably do experience a little more winter conditions than we do here.
I don't know, because they have more maritime, which is like a more... Just a gentler, just don't get as many storms.
Yeah. Maybe I'll get a tidal wave at some point. I don't know.
Maybe.
But, yeah.
They have giant squid in Puget Sound.
So. Well, I'm not swimming out there then.
No, I'm never swimming out there. It's freezing cold all year long.
Yeah, fuck that. No, Portland, Oregon, it's been my experience here ever since I moved here in 2015 that Portland, Oregon has about 1 week of really nasty Michigan type of weather. What do I mean by that? The temperature right now, like I mentioned, is in the teens, 16 degrees outside, I believe, roughly as we record this. And there is a somewhat decent amount of snow. I've definitely seen a lot more drop in Portland here. And if the weather is any indication, within the next couple of weeks or two, we may see a little bit more. But
I think on Tuesday it's supposed to... Snow. Well, it's like 70% chance of snow.
Well, I saw on the weather report that it was going to be like really cold tomorrow, and that Monday, as we're recording this on Sunday, on Monday it'll be it's still around the 16 degree range. But then the further the week goes along, it'll warm up a little bit past the freezing mark. I'm not gonna say it's gonna be in the 60s or anything like that, but if it gets over 32 degrees and consistently stays there with rain/snow, because obviously at night it will still probably dip below 32. I can imagine the snow staying on the ground somewhat, but it's not so far as bad as it has been in years past. It's just really cold.
Yeah, it's much colder than typical for here, and it's that kind of very dry snow. That and the east wind has been biting and so cold.
Now, as someone who has skied before, when you say dry snow, this is like the worst type of snow you're talking about, right? Because you want a good snow would be something you can make a good snowball out of. But if it's dry, it's not going to coalesce.
Right, exactly. When it's dry, it just blows around.
Its only purpose is to be an asshole.
I mean, there's significantly more snow up here on the Alameda Ridge than there is down by I-84 in Sullivan's Gulch. So we're about 500 feet above sea level. They're about 120 feet above sea level down there. So, you know, it makes a difference.
Indeed, indeed. But now, how does the Portland winter rank to winters in other areas of the country you've lived or visited during a winter type period?
The worst winters I experienced were in Kentucky. because it was far enough north to get a little bit of the lake effect snow. It was like regularly 20 degrees there in the wintertime. And that is really, really, really cold.
I agree.
It's very cold here right now. I went dancing on Friday and it was very cold. It was before the snow came, but it was very cold on Friday night. But it was very warm in the club, as you might imagine. So I had bundled up to get to the club and then I sort of unbundled in the club. And I was like leaving the club and thinking, oh my gosh, it's so warm. I'll just leave my shorts on and I won't put my long underwear on under. So I walked outside. It was so cold. I was like screaming the two blocks that I had to run to my car.
I don't get how women deal with winter, like certain women. I mean, there are some, depending on where they work, of course, like some women can, you know, dress just like me or warm and bundle up or whatever. But like office women, women that, you know, routinely have to go into the office every day with like a skirt on or something like that. Like, you know, like the leggings or whatever that, you know, they would wear underneath the skirt and whatnot. They can't be that warm that, you know, you could, that you can deal with that properly. I can imagine it's just one of those unfortunate things of being a woman, I guess, you know?
Well, most of us get to choose whether we wear a skirt or pants these days.
True, fair enough. I mean, it's not the 1940s, Jim.
No, it's not the 70s. In the 70s, definitely women were still supposed to wear skirts. And really, when I was in law school in the very early 2000s, I was told that the most conservative thing to wear was a skirt, but that you could get away with pants.
Are we talking jeans? No, we're not talking jeans. You can't go to court in jeans. You know, this is my closing argument, Your Honor, and you're in a t-shirt, pal. You
know? No, I mean, you would always wear a suit. Be some kind of suit.
Ah, so you're talking like a power suit type deal?
Yeah.
All right. but that is fair. Like, I know in the Senate, for like a couple of weeks, they relaxed the rules that senators had to dress a certain way. And then that senator from Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, showed up in like a hoodie and shorts, you know? And I saw that and it's just like, yeah, put a suit back on. Like you, that it's not that it's a sacred place or something like that, but when you are dealing with, you know, in certain places, when you are dealing with, you know, such heavy, important topics, dressing like me is probably not the most appropriate thing to do. I do think there is something to be said about dressing for the event you go to.
Yeah, and it encourages decorum.
Yeah, I mean, not that Washington is the best example of decorum.
No, no, not at all.
At the moment, at least. But, you know, hopefully, the election this year can maybe hopefully sort some of that out. Famous last words, I know.
Yeah, let's not hold our breath.
Yeah.
I think the worst.
Well, I mean, I am reminded about that Lyndon Johnson quote about, you know, how you teach a white man to, you know, hate a black man or something like that. And he'll, you know, won't notice that that you're, you know, stealing money from him. And if you really get them to the white man to hate the other person, they will gladly empty their pockets for you. And that's a paraphrase. President Johnson said it a lot more eloquently than I did, even though he's not the most subtle. He was not the most subtle guy when he was around, but fair point. This country likes to shoot itself in the foot just to make the other be worse. And, you know, how can you really fight against someone that has no problem hurting themselves if that means you get hurt worse?
Yeah, I mean, that's a zero-sum game, right?
I know, like
it's mutually just escalation.
Mutually assured destruction. I, you know, I survived 14 years of that. Anyway, long story short, it is frigid outside right now. If you are in a part of the country to where the weather is really bad, I mean, I think back last year around this time when I was walking in a mile and a half to and from work in negative 11 degree weather, not fun. Not fun at all. I mean, people, you know, in my situation, you do what you got to do and, you know, and just prepare accordingly, I guess. And now especially is a perfect time if you do have like spare cash or you have the ability to volunteer or something like that. Find a homeless shelter in your town and do what you can to support. Like, even if it's only giving like 10, 20 bucks or something like that. That's something. That's something.
Sure.
Yeah, because there are definitely people that are outside right now in weather like this. And, you know, for the Pacific Northwest, for most of the year, you can, if you play your cards right, you could theoretically live outside and, you know, maybe a little frigid sometimes, but you can survive. But weather like this is
very hard to survive without shelter.
Yeah. So
without some kind of shelter. And gosh, you know, the thing that's happened here in Portland is just so many trees coming down, really big old trees. There's one that fell on the corner of Belmont and 13th, blocking Belmont, the entire, it's a pretty wide street. This giant old tree was just lying across it. Tons of trees have fallen on houses. The people I was with today, their power had been out since yesterday morning at 10 a.m. Mm. And there was a church at the corner of their block that caught fire last night in the early morning because there were people living in the gymnasium part of the church, and they had a generator so that they could run electric heaters, and they were running the generator inside.
Ooh.
Women in their 70s died in the fire. A number of people escaped, I think, you know, maybe with some injuries or something, but it was a 3-alarm fire. It was a huge deal. And that was just right next to their house. So they were up since like 4 a.m. with, you know, fire trucks and everything going on. So
like a couple of days back, there was like a fire truck or something that did drive by the house. And Mimsy was just like, what the hell? What is that noise? Do I got to be scared? What the hell?
Never heard that one before.
So if there is an organization out there that you can support in any way possible, by all means, this is the time of year to go ahead and do that, because more people are going to be in need this time of year. If it's July, even in the coldest spot in July, you know, most people are going to be able to, you know, get by and, you know, without having to necessarily have shelter. But yeah, you got to help. This week, I'm interested in to see what it's going to be like at work because of the cold.
Mm.
Yeah, because those dogs, man.
Does humping, the dogs humping, does that increase in the cold? Are they trying to keep warm?
I hope not. The funny part about the job, and you know, the inner 12-year-old boy in me is going to laugh every time this happens, is that when dogs get too excited and their arousal level goes up, I mean, arousal for a dog means a lot more than just sexual arousal, but that is something that they do. Like, dogs will run around and play and be all excited, and then before they know it, it's like, you know what? I gotta start fucking some.
I'm having such a good time.
Better start fucking, yeah. So I've seen a Great Dane try to have sex with a Saint Bernard. It's like a regular orgy there. Like, there have been three ways. There was a poor dog that was getting mounted from the front and the back. I don't know how they worked that out. There was another dog that was mounting one dog and going at it, and then another dog mounted the mounter,
mm-hmm.
and then the mounter was like, "Hold on, pal, I'm the picture here."
Like, get off my jog.
Yeah, something like that. So yeah, that's part of my job, and it's much better than customer service, I'll tell you that. I'd rather deal with humping dogs all day than another customer with their blank vacant stares and their more money and just want to fuck them all.
Fuck them all to death.
Yeah Mr. Garrison for the win. Anyway, the dogs are amazing. Dogs are amazing. And yeah, just being able to spend like half your shift just like caring for dogs. Like, one thing I've noticed too is that you really, the more dogs that are around, the more you really have to hold back your urge to be super kind to each and every one of them. Not that you're being a dick, but you have to have some level of control. And there are dogs out there that if they know they can, you know, have you wrapped around their paw, they will take advantage of that.
Oh, yeah. I would be terrible at this job. terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough too because there are some dogs there that are just like really nice. Like there was one dog there that, you know, from day one, like just fell in love with me. It's like, Mister, you're the greatest. Yeah, jumping around and all that. But the dog doesn't apparently, you know, outside of the daycare have as much of a social life as it should.
And if in this town too,
it wouldn't shock me if that dog of a decent size was living in an apartment. You know, which I mean, there are many reasons why I don't have a dog myself, but you know, living in a place this size, even for a smaller dog, it's just not appropriate.
No, it's just not enough space. Certainly, yeah. If you have cats as well.
Exactly. I mean, and the queen and princess, you know, are they are enjoying their time just here by themselves. If there was a little dog, you know, around, Annie maybe a little friendly, but Mimsy would tear any dog apart.
Yeah, Mimsy would not be into it.
Yeah, she'd be hiding, and then like anytime you'd like look at her, that look on her face would be like, "You brought that fucker in here."
Yeah, she would not be happy.
Yes, indeed, indeed. But speaking of happy, we've talked about music many times on this show, and we've talked about it recently as well. One band that makes the both of us happy is the Beatles.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so...
I'd say we're Beatles fans.
Beatle fanatics. Ooh, yes. So I came across an article from The Independent UK. I believe they're like a tabloid or something like that. So in terms of like real news, probably not the most reliable source to go to. But this is their ranking of the Beatles albums in order of greatness. Now... not going to read the article here. I'll just bring up the album name and the placement that they have it on, and we'll talk about whether we feel that placement is necessary. What do you think?
That sounds good.
All right. So coming in at number 12, Yellow Submarine. The original album release of Yellow Submarine, side A, was essentially... the Beatles songs that were in that movie. There were some that were written specifically for the movie, like Hey Bulldog and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you also had All You Need Is Love and, of course, Yellow Submarine as well. Side two was, of the original version of the album, was the orchestrations that George Martin did that were in the cartoon of Yellow Submarine, which... I never listened to that full side.
Right.
In the 2000s-ish, I believe, I don't recall a specific time, they did come out with a new version of that album. Side A was still the same, but side B, instead of the orchestration, it had essentially the rest of the songs that were in the movie. So I believe they put on like Strawberry Fields Forever and a couple other things as well. Hmm. So if we are talking only about the original version of the Yellow Submarine album, I can tolerate this being at the bottom of the list just because only half of the album is Beatles material.
Yeah, so that definitely seems like it should make it, you know, the last on the list.
Yeah. All right, number 11. This is a very solid album by the group, and it also introduced me to one Buck Owens because of the Ringo song Act Naturally, the cover he did, but Beatles for Sale. This is the album that had No Reply, I'm a Loser, 8 Days a Week. I could probably deal with an argument that would have this be a little bit higher, but not by much. I mean, we're talking maybe 10 or 9, if I'm being really giving. You know, like 8 Days a Week, great song. You know, Act Naturally, I'm glad that was there to kind of introduce me to the idea that country music is not just the stuff I see on Hee Haw, even though Buck Owens was a longtime host on Hee Haw.
So tell me about that. So you heard...
Ringo's
version.
Back Naturally. And then I found out that was written by Buck Owens. And then from there, I, you know, went out of my way to listen to some Buck Owens and became a fan from there.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Maybe not number 11, but I somewhere near this, I'm comfortable with that. How about you?
Yeah, I think so, for sure.
Okay. Number 10. We're both going to disagree with this immensely. Let It Be.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best albums, maybe three or four.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably put it probably four or five on my list if I took the time. But again, it's give or take, you know, depending on the day there. I do think their very last recorded album, not released album, but recorded album, Abbey Road, would probably be the top of my list. But Let It Be is definitely up there just because it showed that if they had not had the financial problems that they had because they wanted to get Alan Klein as their manager during the Abbey Road period, and they had somehow stuck it out in terms of, you know, doing what George Harrison suggested on the Get Back documentary of, you know, like, the Beatles make an album, then they take a break for a couple of years, and then solo-wise, they do their own albums, and then after a few years, they get back together again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like one of those things, like, kind of like In Utero from Nirvana, too. It's just like, what could have been? Because it's like they were dipping their toes into some different types of music, really, than what they had been playing up to that point. And yeah, like, it's what could have been, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so what would you put it on, approximately, on your list?
I mean, I think four. Because you said four or five, and I said three or four, so I think four.
I think that's a good spot. I'd put it at four myself, too, yeah. And, yeah, it's definitely would be much higher than their number nine with the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
This one,
much earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to probably put this second to last on my list. Now, having said that, a bad Beatles album is going to be better than most anything else out there. Let's be serious, folks. So even saying something is the worst from the Beatles, most musicians would cut off a limb gladly to have an album of that quality. But this one was, a lot of it was just cover songs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's unfortunately what the music business was at that time. A lot of times the bands were not necessarily writing the music on their own, but you know, for what the Beatles ended up becoming, this feels just rushed in a lot of ways. Yeah, so like I said, though, like I've said on the show before, though, like, one benefit of this album is that because they covered people like, you know, Chuck Berry, like Smokey Robinson on that list, they,
mm-hmm.
like I did with the Beatles For Sale and Buck Owens, they had a lot of people, you know, say, hey, if, you know, this person wrote that song, I should go check out their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I think, you know, the album kind of gets a pass for me, but it's not one that I've ever routinely put on.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever heard it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've heard some songs, give or take, in like a playlist or something like that. But anyway, let's go on to the next one. Number eight on their list is the very first Beatles album, Please Please Me.
Really? Interesting.
I can live with it being here. Generally, when it comes to the Beatles, my enjoyment of theirs does come from some of their later works. You know, the like this album right here, they're still very much sounding like 50s rock bands, you know, because that's who influenced them when they made this album. They were in their very early 20s, and I don't think George Harrison was even 20 yet, you know, when they did this album.
Little George, a little baby.
Yeah, but it's interesting, much like Elvis. You know, because Elvis with, you know, That's All Right Mama, that's a cover of an old blues standard. And you could tell it was that, you know, he listened to the original, you know, Elvis in when he sang that. But he was such an artist that he still put his spin on it. That's why people associate that song with him and not necessarily the original artist. But you should all go check out that original artist. And kind of same here as well. Like, the songs are very basic for what they ended up becoming. And again, a lot of them were covers. But, you know, think of the energy on the, like, the last track on this album, Twist and Shout. And that was, I mean, I believe the album, if I'm not mistaken, was like recorded in a couple of day period. And, you know, this was the last song that they recorded for that album because they knew, you know, Lennon would blow his voice out, which he ended up doing.
Interesting.
Yeah. So for me, it would be lower on my list, not, you know, necessarily near the bottom, but it's just really one of those that I can see the genius that bloomed from that seed, but I'm not there for the seed. I'm there for the fruit that comes after it blooms.
Gotcha. Yeah, me too. I feel the same.
All right. The next one is another soundtrack album that they did. Help.
Hey.
At number 7. This is the top. This is the album to where they started blossoming. With songs like Help, you got to hide your love away and stuff like that. You know, Lennon and McCartney and Harrison were showing just how much they were being influenced by, you know, the music of the day from people like the Byrds, Bob Dylan, and stuff like that. One of the songs on Help, I believe, was where, if I am not mistaken, and I could be wrong, but I believe this is the album that George Harrison first started playing the 12-string Rickenbacker.
Oh.
That, you know, people like Roger Gwynn from the Byrds were influenced by and started doing themselves. So this does also have one of the most covered songs in recorded history, Yesterday.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the great, love songs, maybe?
People consider it a love song, but he wrote it about his mother passing. So but again, I mean, we've talked about that before with the Beatles, that the beauty of what they did as songwriters and musicians was to have their songs be that open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because on the one side, it does kind of sound like, you know, Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away type of deal. And you're reminiscing about a lost love,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas McCartney, you know, meant it for being sad that his mother died.
Yeah.
You know, much different meaning. But again, the beauty of that song is that you can have, if it means something to you, then that's what it means.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty, I think, of music and poetry, is that it's always about you when you're reading it.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to it.
Yep, exactly. So I would probably have this a little bit lower, but we're talking 8 or 9. I think there are some great songs on here, but overall, still sort of in that period that where they sound like 50s bands.
Mm-hmm.
But quickly growing out of it. I mean, it's amazing the Beatles was able to do so much in such a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
All right, number 6, another soundtrack, the soundtrack to their very first film, A Hard Day's Night.
Mm, I like that song.
The album overall is pretty solid. It's, again, an early one from them. I think, you know, I would probably have this, it would definitely be ranked above Help, but not by much. So if I put Help at 8, I would put this at 7. So it's not in a necessarily wrong spot. More often than not, I would probably be shocked if it didn't turn out that more people like the movie than they do the album.
Sure.
Because the songs that they, you know, put in the movie, just being able to see them there, I guess, you know, makes it a little more fun than just popping on the album.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a music video at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there had been, like, in the 30s, I guess, that there used to be jukeboxes that they made that would have essentially music videos playing there. They didn't call them music videos, obviously. I forgot the name of the machine, but it was just, like, a short little 2-3 minute clip where somebody would, you know, it was filmed in front of a camera of the day, was recording a very simple song. And because it was new technology, people ended up falling in love with it and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, this helped inspire the Monkees. And the Monkees from there, with Mike Nesmith going on to, there was, oh man, I forgot the name of it. I mean, I didn't even think I would be talking about it. But on Nickelodeon, they actually had a half-hour show that was music videos.
Mm.
That was produced by Mike Nesmith, and it was the proof of concept in a way for MTV, because this was the first thing in America, I guess, that came out. Because again, you know, when they made stuff like music videos, like Tom Petty, for instance, talked about not wanting to go, I believe, on the Merv Griffin show. Mm. So that's why he made his first video in the 70s, so he didn't have to appear live. You know, a lot of times they would film these things, but didn't really know what to do with them until the show that was on Nickelodeon. And then from there, 1981, we know what happened with MTV.
Yeah.
Yep. There's your history lesson, folks. All right. We're in the top five here. Number five, I would probably put this a little bit higher myself. Rubber Sole.
You know, I really like Rubber Sole. I think, where's it? Four?
Five.
Five. I think that's fine for me.
The more I think about it, I guess I sort of agree too. It deserves to be around this area, because I think about it, I would probably put Let It Be in terms of my preferences above this, and I'd put Let It Be at four.
Right.
So
exactly my thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Because of this album here was really this and one that we're going to be talking about, further up the list here, really started showing that the band was just, expanding in their musical artistry by leaps and bounds. This was so much different than the albums that they had put out previously. This is the album where they found their voice, in my opinion.
Nice.
All right. Any other thoughts?
No, I mean, I agree with you. You just always say everything before I have anything to say.
You're an eloquent motherfucker, Tim.
You are. Just everything you say is just perfectly correct.
All right. Shall I go on to number four?
Please do.
All right. Number four, released in 1968, The White Album.
Now, this I would put two.
I?
Number nine.
I would probably put it at number two myself,
They're just more man.
Yeah. I know where I lay at night. because obviously we're not done with the list. There's going to be another one that we're going to talk about that I would have higher. But this album, I would say, as far as John Lennon songs, at least, I think he did some of his best work with the Beatles on this album. My absolute favorite, song of his that if there is a short list for the best John Lennon song ever written, I would put this on there. Dear Prudence.
Mm-hmm.
Such a beautiful song. He wrote that about Mia Farrow's sister. It was because of the Maharishi retreat that they all went on, and John had quickly gotten disillusioned and found out that the guy was a shyster and just, there for the money. Imagine that, a religious figure doing that. But when they were there, Prudence Farrow, Mia Farrow's sister, was really devoted. And she would end up just staying in her room meditating for most of the day. And Lennon was just like, we're in a foreign country in a beautiful land. Why are you not coming outside to play? Enjoy the sun. Come on, live life.
Mm-hmm.
Because Lennon later expounded in his song, Imagine, there's really nothing else after this, folks.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little depressing, but yeah, I like the seize the moment, live for today.
Exactly.
Experience all that you can experience.
Yeah, and so many great songs off this album. I mean, this is one where George Harrison really came into his own. While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, what else can you say about, George Harrison's work there? But you got Blackbird. You got Paul McCartney writing the song that he wrote in response to I Can See for Miles from The Who, Helter Skelter.
Oh.
He wanted to write a song that outdid The Who, and it was Helter Skelter. And I think he pretty much succeeded. It's unfortunate Charles Manson had to try to appropriate that song.
But it is, yes.
It's a good song nonetheless. And I do think back of the time to where at a bar that my mom used to work at, when they switched their jukebox from the playing 45 LPs to CDs.
Mm-hmm.
They had the White Album on there, and I spent $5 replaying the song on the album Revolution 9 at a shit-kicking country bar. this is the type of crowd, in Grand Rapids that we're into both kinds of music. This is also the place where my mom got Johnny Paycheck's autograph for me.
Oh, right.
Oh, me playing Revolution 9 there didn't go over too well.
On repeat.
On repeat. Each song was a quarter, so $5 worth of quarters. Think about that. She ended up having to unplug it and plug it back in.
I bet she's so upset with you.
Yeah. Not the first time, not the last. All right, we're going to the top three. Do you want to know the Independence number three?
Yes.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
It's a good one.
It's a good one. I would probably put, even though we got two more choices left, I would probably put this at my number one. I could see on a different day choosing a different album, and we're not done with the list yet, so that's why I've not named it. But I just keep coming back to this. It's like when we talked about, Now and Then being released and how that kind of, influenced me to go back and listen to their music again. And just this album just shouldn't work as well as it does, but it does. And what puts this album into one of the greatest albums ever made is the last song, A Day in the Life. Without that song on that album, the other songs are good, but just A Day in the Life is just so much better. And to think that a popular music act would come out with something like that just blows my mind. I mean, it'd be like the Backstreet Boys coming out with something, that makes everybody's jaw drop or something. But what do you think about that album? Is that a good placement for you?
I think it is. I think that's a good placement for me. I don't think I would put it at number one for sure.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the most well-known song off of this album, if we're being honest here, is probably With a Little Help from My Friends, and that's not even because of their version of the song. It would be because of Joe Cocker. They didn't have an anthem hit on there like they did with some of their other albums, but wow, just for me, right now I'd have to put it at my number one.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, so we go to their number two.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. This is the last album that they recorded, but not the last one they released, Abbey Road. And I would have to put this at my number two right now. A week from now, if you ask me, I may say it's number one. So this and Sgt. Pepper would probably rotate based on the day when you ask me. But in terms of anthem songs, this has it. Come Together. George Harrison... at this point, it was undeniable that George Harrison was an equal, if not better, songwriter than both McCartney and Lennon. Because while McCartney and Lennon, in their solo careers, came out with some great songs, the only person who consistently charted on a regular basis was George.
Yeah.
I mean, even well into the 80s with the Cloud Nine album and his work with the Traveling Wilburys, he was still getting attention, whereas McCartney around that same time was the Beatle McCartney. He wasn't making albums that were, it's unfair to say it, but it's like people... The longer an artist is around, the more people ignore their new stuff. And that's somewhat unfair because McCartney has put out a lot of good songs in his solo career, but George just had that voice as a songwriter that was able to still connect with people, even for something like a cover song,
Mm-hmm.
Where would you put it?
I would put it as number one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, my choice.
I'm very interested to hear their number one.
All right, do you want me to go to that?
Yeah.
All right. This came out in 66. This was released after Rubber Soul, but before Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, Revolver.
Well, Revolver's good.
Yeah, this was an experimental album in a lot of ways, but they were able to... learn a lot from this that did them well in later years. It does have some good songs, Here, There, and Everywhere, Got to Get You Into My Life, Tomorrow Never Knows, And Your Bird Can Sing. It has some great songs. Harrison with Taxman, I believe.
Taxman.
Yeah, I believe that opened the album, if I'm not mistaken. Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
Yeah, but overall... I don't know if this would not be my number one. It is an important album. Maybe I'd put it at my number five.
Yeah, that seems right to me.
Yeah, I mean, because if you look at it in terms of what that album did to inspire them, for their later albums, it was vital.
Yeah.
But overall, yeah, so that was their list. the beauty of any sort of list like this, whether it's from, you know, places like The Independent or just our own brains, is that it's there for just discussion purposes. So if you are upset by what The Independent said for this particular list, don't be. Just put on a Beatles album and enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, who cares what the critics say?
Yeah, douchebag British people, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, how about we take a moment to let one of our friends at the Deluxe Edition Network tell our lovely audience about their show.
That sounds perfect.
All right, so sit back, relax, hang tight, and listen to this.
Boing!
Town Podcast is a podcast that features your town's dark, wild, and sometimes unbelievable past that will have you thinking there is no way that really happened here.
Matt, Meg, and Zach dust off the books and hit the streets and the occasional nursing home to unveil your town's past.
From small towns to where we live to big cities before they were what they are today, this is your town, your stories.
Self-esteem is a bitch.
It can be. It can be, Tim.
It really can be.
It doesn't have to be, but it can be.
You're right. It doesn't have to be because, I mean, as we continue to discuss mental health type of topics on the show here, naughty girl. As we continue to discuss mental health topics on the show here, I mean, the more it, you know, kind of solidifies in my head that, yeah, a lot of times we beat ourselves up individually much more than, you know, we would anybody else. Like, I think we always hold ourselves up to a higher standard than we would put other people, because if another person that I know is having a bad day and fumbling around, I'm just going to tell them it's okay, think about it, blah blah blah, kind of try to console them and just tell them that, you know, life is what it is. Sometimes good things happen, sometimes they don't, but if someone said that to me, I'm not going to believe them. With my brain being what it is too, it's like I've talked before, it can be tough to accept the fact that you're living just as regular a life as anybody else.
I think it can be hard. You know, it's a form of being self-centered, right? This idea that you're the center of the universe and everybody's thinking about you and having some opinion about you, when really probably nobody notices you anyway. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think we exaggerate our own influence on people.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of when I lived in Sacramento. They had a grocery store chain there, and I worked there briefly. But I, you know, and when I was putting the application and doing a web search about the place, I found this website that this guy that used to work at the corporate office for this chain store made, and it was just him bad mouthing the corporation and whatnot. And it's like, this was just this guy's website. He didn't, you know, put citations up in terms of showing his work about whether his, you know, grievances were valid or not. But even if he did, like, he was just a regular guy. And like him putting that website out is just like, why are you doing that to yourself?
Yeah.
You know, wasting your money I can imagine I was probably one of the few people that even came across that website.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, but what we wanted to do this week for our main event is go back to our friends at Psychology Today and talk about an interesting article that we came across from Dr. Sebastian Ocklenberg. Hope I pronounced that correctly. It is called How Lying Destroys Self-Esteem, 5 New Scientific Insights. And I think this is important to think about. The key points of the article: lying generally lowers self-esteem and leads to negative emotions. Even remembering a lie has negative consequences on psychological well-being, and people lie more about themselves than about other people. We're all guilty of it. And I can definitely see, you know, through examples that I've lived in the past to where, yeah, me telling a little white lie on one day snowballed into something further down the road that ended up making me feel like absolute shit.
And yeah,
not a fun thing to do. But the purpose why we talk about stuff like this on the show is the more it's talked about, the more people can understand that, you know, hey, other people do this too. Mm-hmm. And if you have that in your head, it makes it easier to not do it. Don't beat yourself up if you do, because again, we are all human. Nobody's going to be absolutely perfect forever and ever. But if you know the signs to look for, it can help you out. We're going to go down with the bullet points here, read the bullet points and the paragraphs associated with that, and then we will open up some discussion here. Did you want me to start?
No, let me start.
Ooh, eager.
Mm-hmm.
All right, good girl. Let's go.
All right, number one, lying lowers self-esteem and leads to more negative emotions. The basic hypothesis of the study was that since lying is considered immoral, it may lead to lower self-esteem and negative emotions in the liar. The first part of the study was an online experiment in which volunteers had to read about different self-centered, for example, lying about expertise on a job interview, and other-centered, for example, lying about liking a new dress that a friend bought, dilemmas. Volunteers had to answer whether they lied or told the truth the last time they were in a similar situation. Moreover, the self-esteem of the volunteers and the four negative emotions, nervousness, regret, discomfort, and unhappiness, were determined with questionnaires. The results revealed that for self-centered dilemmas, 41.6 of volunteers had lied. For other-centered dilemmas, 45.5 had told a lie. Participants who lied had significantly lower self-esteem and more negative feelings than those who told the truth for both types of dilemmas. So here we're looking at, you know, half, almost half the population lying and feeling bad about it.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to stuff like job interview stuff, I can take a little fib compared to a lie. What do I mean by that? Like, if I put on my resume or something like that, that I had a doctorate, yeah, I'm lying. But if I essentially do like they like, and I believe that this is a thing to where like sex workers that are looking to, you know, get off the streets and not be a sex worker anymore and, you know, go back and do a regular 9-to-5 job. There are people that will tell them to use a fancy name that sounds like a business or something you would do at a business and, you know, put it that way. And then maybe you have to explain this somewhere down the line if they do find out what you really are talking about, I guess. But yeah, like if like me, there was when I worked at Best Buy, I was briefly in charge of doing the schedule for the folks that did my position, the sales operator job. So we're talking three people. But, you know, saying on my resume that I've been in charge of scheduling before for a group of people. Not exactly telling a lie, but
that's a lie. That's not a lie.
But it's somewhat of an exaggeration because most people that are looking for that are looking for, you know, at, you know, doing schedules for groups at minimum of like 20 people or something like that, you know.
But they didn't say that. They said groups, and three people is a group. Mm. It's a fine group. It's a good group.
Well, there you go. Another thing I did like that they talked about on here that can be tough is the other-centered.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to happen a lot more in relationships. You know, stuff like, it could be something as simple as, you know, does this look nice on me? And you don't want to hurt that person's feelings and go, yeah, a thumbs up type of deal. Or like food. For instance, if someone makes a food dish that another person just doesn't work for them, it can be tough. You don't want to hurt the person's feelings, especially when they put the work in to, you know, make that dish for you. You know, I remember some friends of mine back in Grand Rapids, they had just gotten married and, you know, I was over to their house for dinner and just the husband at one point, you know, told the wife who had made dinner, I don't like this. And just like the way he says, like, dude, you know,
somebody cooked for you and you're going to say that.
Yeah. I mean, his point, and it was a fair point, was that people should have the freedom to say that. I mean, I would counter that the way he went about it was abrupt. And this was at the time when I was hanging out with folks that were regularly going to church. So he was one of those people that, you know, women are submissive. I stand by feeling uncomfortable about how he said that to her. But there is something to be said about, I mean, if you were going to be living, you know, if the intention is to live with someone for a long time, you know, you do have to be able to have those conversations about, I wasn't a big fan of that. Let's try and have, you know, X, Y, and Z later for dinner or something like that. You can break that news without being an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be tough.
Yeah. I mean, people want, everybody wants to be a good cook. And I get where he's coming from, that you don't want to tell people that you like something you don't like, because then you get more of the thing that you don't like because you've told people that you like it.
You like this liver. Ooh.
Right. I'll make it for you every time you come over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you want to avoid those kinds of situations.
And that's what that point was talking about, really. I mean, because in your head, you're trying to be nice, but think of all the discomfort you're going to have down the road if the person that you are dating consistently makes you liver and onions because you didn't have the courage to say, I don't like liver and onions. That will lead to problems and lead to a potential, you know, blow up in terms of, you know, someone finally getting sick of it. And if you like had a bad day at work, traffic was bad getting home, and you're already grumpy and mean or whatever, and then you get home and your partner has liver and onions for you, that could be something to where, like a pressure cooker, it's got to go off, you know?
I tell you what, if I came home to liver and onions ever, I would be so disgusted.
Yeah. And you'd be on the street, too.
I'd be like, Dad, why are you cooking animal organs?
Yeah, organ meat. I mean, muscle, like ground beef and all that. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The only reason I'm a meat eater is that I don't have to butcher the meat myself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. So, anyway, speaking of that, shall I go into number two?
Yes, please.
All right. Number two, just remembering a lie is enough to lower self-esteem and reduce positive emotions. In experiment two, a similar design was used, but in this part of the study, no dilemmas were presented. Instead, volunteers had to come up with past dilemmas themselves. They were asked to either come up with situations in which they lied or a situation in which they had decided to tell the truth. Moreover, negative and positive emotions were determined. The results were clear. Volunteers who remembered a situation in which they had lied had lower self-esteem and less positive emotions than people who remembered a situation in which they told the truth. This does boil down to what I mentioned earlier. People are going to beat themselves up. People are more likely to remember that one mistake than the 9 things they did right out of the 10 things they did overall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because of that, yes, their self-esteem will go down. I think the important thing here, as it points out, is the importance of, even if you have to force yourself, look for something good that you did. You know, it's like we talked on last week's episode about the podcast. I could, by comparing myself to other people, find myself having lower self-esteem because my show is not at to the standard of what it is for other people. But why am I not celebrating the good things that the show has done? Like I mentioned, we don't have a big audience, but we have one.
Yeah.
You know? And that is something to be proud of. And I think, you know, again, going back to this bullet point here, you really have to do your best to train your brain to acknowledge when you do good. You know, you want to be open when you do bad. You want to be open to criticism, but you also have to keep on reminding yourself that you do good as well. And that can be very tough when self-esteem is low, when you have depression and stuff
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm. It is. It can be really hard. But I think you're right that you have to train your brain to think about the positive rather than the negative.
Like we mentioned, since people do kind of feel that they are the center of the universe, it can be tough because, you know, like I've mentioned before about me, like regularly, I usually, if I'm thinking about myself or my past or whatever, I'm usually thinking about the bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they did happen, and that bad things happen to everybody. It's just not all me.
Mm-hmm.
I did plenty of good as well. And it's important to continually remind myself that I did do good and blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
All right. How about
let's go to the next one? Yeah. To number three. People lie more about themselves than about others. In the third experiment, the scientists aimed to replicate the findings of the first two experiments using a diary research approach. Volunteers were asked to keep track of all their lies for one day. They were also asked to write down their lies and the motives behind lying. Overall, 22% of the volunteers told a self-centered lie, 8.2% an other-oriented lie, and 69.7% did not lie. People who had lied had lower self-esteem and felt less positive about themselves than those who told the truth. Interesting. So volunteers, you know, 70% of them did not lie. But we, you know, we were talking about above the 40%, 50% who did lie.
Because people are lying about not lying.
Right, exactly. Like they know they have to write down their lies. And so they, it's an artificial...
The numbers don't add up.
Yeah, the numbers don't add up, man.
I think this does show to... You know, I think I sort of touched on it about how, you know, easy it is for somebody lost in their own head to, you know, not, you know, necessarily see the good about themselves compared to other people. You know, you can have somebody who's depressed and thinks they're shit that can give a great pep talk to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think part of this, as we mentioned, is doing your best to kind of break yourself out of that cycle and think about the good things that you do. Because I think a lot of it, too, boils down to, I mean, like, the people that lie just don't want to seem out of step with everybody. Like, we just, you know, before we recorded, wrapped up watching the new South Park special.
Mm-hmm.
And Clyde, one of the characters on there, was not able, his parents would not allow him to get the new energy drink Cred that all the kids in school were drinking, yet he ended up through means getting an empty bottle of Cred and then, you know, filling it with apple juice, which led to further problems down the road. You know, one little lie ended up spiraling and becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, which affected a lot of people. And I think even though we're talking about an example from a show like South Park, this happens a lot.
Oh, sure.
You know, think about people in relationships more than anything. I mean, we've talked about this before, how like in how people can be at a point in a relationship where deep down they know things have to change and like the actions of another person are causing them bad stuff. But if you don't say nothing, it's not going to change. It's just going to get worse.
Absolutely. And it's hard to be honest in those situations, really.
It is hard, but, you know, the older I get, the more I see the importance of having the courage to be able to tell the truth in situations that it needs to be said. Because it has been my experience that telling the truth by not bottling things up and just not saying, and everything's fine, is not healthy. Now, does that mean you have to unleash on everything? No. I mean, because, you know, maybe something is happening that is happening now, but it's not something, and I'm being vague here, folks, but an action is being done now that maybe you don't want to say nothing about, but it's not going to be anything that's going to be life-shattering or anything like that.
Yeah.
So maybe you don't necessarily have to go off and tell the truth for absolutely every single thing ever, but that doesn't mean lie either. You know, just it's like if you're with somebody and let's go back to the food example, they want to make something that you're not necessarily a fan of, but you see that other person gets real joy from it. Maybe you don't say you don't like it, okay? And I'm not saying it would be the liver and onions example. It could just be a different way of making spaghetti or something. You know, just maybe there are some things to where you can not necessarily have to tell the truth and not have it be a bigger problem down the road. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm not the kind of person that would tell somebody, like, I didn't really like it. You know, I think I'm always going to say I like it because I don't want to hurt somebody's feelings.
But I think, you know, and I've seen this in action with you as well. Like you would also, like, not necessarily that same day or something like that, but further down the road, I think you at times have also shown that you're willing to say, hey, instead of this, why don't we try this instead?
Mm.
And that ends up, you know, allows you to say the truth that you wanted to say, because maybe somebody's making something in a way that you don't like including soy sauce while cooking burgers. But it was, you were able to relate it in a way that empowered the other person to make them feel still better while still you telling the truth.
Really? Mm-hmm. How did I do that?
I just said, I mean, you were able to tell the truth of, I don't like it when you do that, but you would take steps to say, if you try it like this, you will get a better result.
Oh,
that type of deal.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
All right. I throw a compliment your way and you want to bust my balls?
I'll bust your balls, baby.
There we go. All right. Shall I go on to number four?
Yes, number four, please.
All right. 22% of people lie every day and 19% rarely tell a lie. In the fourth and last experiment, a longitudinal approach was used. Volunteers had to track their lying behavior and self-esteem for 5 days. The results showed that there are a lot of differences between people regarding how much they lie. 22% of people reported that they had lied on each of the 5 days, and 19% that said that they did not tell a single lie on any of the 5 days. Kind of hard to believe the second part, but I guess I'm just too cynical, I guess, because...
The thing about it, though, is that it's a perfect bell curve. 20% on each side is like the outlying 20%. And most people, the other 60% of people, are closer to the middle.
I can see that more. Yeah, because lies happen. Everybody goes through it. Most people just deal with basic little white lies more than anything and whatever. But yeah, I do think you're right that more people do end up falling in the middle, not necessarily with the lying every day type of deal, but it happens. You know, and depending on the type of lie we're talking about, if it's innocent, great. If it's not, that's a different story altogether. But I think to your point, because of the bell curve that you talked about, the important thing to, again, remember here is this is something to just not beat yourself up over, because you may find yourself in a situation where you do throw out a lie. I remember, and I've told the story before, as a kid, when I told everybody in my school that I had saw Bill Cosby at a gas station in a limousine. And my teacher ended up stating, oh, he was just in town performing at Grand Valley State. And it was just like, cool, my lie worked.
Was that the truth?
I don't know. It's certainly not impossible, because Cosby did come to town on a couple of occasions, but I can't say for certain. The teacher could have been saving my ass because I was at that particular point. It's about fifth or sixth grade. That's when, puberty started kicking in for some folks, and that's when awkwardness starts kicking in for folks like me as well. And I think one way I was trying to still remain in the cool kids group at that particular time was tall stories.
Uh-huh. Tall tales.
Tall tales, Tall tales from a tall guy. So, but lots of lies. I mean, I didn't get caught on that one, so that was good there. But, you know, it happens. Don't beat yourself up.
Okay, number five.
All right.
You know, lying is already so bad for you that you don't have to beat yourself up about it. But anyway, number five.
Mm-hmm.
Lying specifically lowers self-esteem on days a lie is told. In the fourth experiment, the scientists were able to replicate the findings of the previous experiments that lying was associated with lower self-esteem on the day the lie was told. Moreover, they analyzed the association between lying and self-esteem over 5 days. When someone told a lie, their self-esteem was lower than on the day before. This shows that people who lie do not generally have low self-esteem, but that the act of lying decreases self-esteem. We don't feel good about ourselves when we're lying.
Yeah, it's not a good feeling. Like, if, let's go back to the relationship example. If someone that you're in a relationship with makes you a plate of food and you're not a fan of it, but you say that you are, you're going to feel bad because you know you're hurting them in a way. You know, words do have power. And if you had just said something along the lines of, it's not for me, people understand that. People aren't going to have their feelings hurt, because that is something that is a message that you can relay in a respectful way. But if you don't, you feel bad that day because, you know that that lie, if the other person found out, would it would make them feel bad. And again, over time, if we're talking with the food example, if that person keeps on making you that food because they think you're liking it, by the time you get tired of it and actually do say something, they're going to be like, why did I spend 6 months making this for you if I thought this was your favorite dish? Why didn't you say something? Because more often than not, in situations like that specifically, yeah, you're going to have people say, I wouldn't have done it if I thought you didn't like it.
Right. Yeah. I think that's where you get into trouble, is telling people things that you like or that you don't like.
Agreed. And I think because we are at the conclusion of the article here, the important thing, just don't lie if you don't have to. Maybe you
don't. No forced errors.
Maybe you don't need to tell the person on the day that the event happens the truth about how you feel about something they do. Maybe you do need to take a couple of days to formulate how to say it, or even if you need to say it, you know, because maybe you come home and your partner plays a sitar, is there with a sitar, and you're like, where the fuck did you get a sitar? And you're trying to play it, and but you're like, oh, it's great, thumbs up, but you're walking out of the room with your fingers in your ears. And then if they give it up after a couple of days, no harm, no foul, I guess. But you know, you do got to have the courage to be able to tell the people that are really close to you in your life, especially, you know, if it is important that it keeps on coming up in your head that it's something needs to be said, say it. Mm-hmm. Don't beat yourself up if you do lie, because we're human. We've all been there. But I think the importance of what this article is pointing out is there are some things that you just should not lie about. Mm-hmm. And if you do, it will hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree. I could have said it better myself, Tim.
You eloquent motherfucker.
Yeah.
All right, so thanks again to the good folks at Psychology Today for this wonderful article. Is there anything else you wish to relay to the good folks at home?
I don't think so. I just hope everybody has a really great week.
Let's have a warm week out there too, right?
Let's try to have a warm week. We've got, you know, winter weather here with us for a few more days, I believe.
Yeah, in the Pacific Northwest, if you're in other parts of the country listening, sucks to be you. But well, we're going to be fine here by the end of the week, hopefully, until another cold front comes in. But yeah, so each Monday, we'll have something in this podcast space to entertain your ear holes. Until we meet again, we bid you adieu.
So long, folks.
I got nothing.
Subscribe to Friends Talking Nerdy on iTunes, the Google Play Music Store, as well as Spotify. Remember to support Friends Talking Nerdy on Patreon. Goodbye, darling.